This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning. This is Thursday Breakfast, and I am Leela. Here with Priya. Good morning, Priya.
Good morning, Leela. How's it going?
Yeah, it's been good. The weather has been a little bit more consistent, and I actually got sunburnt the other day.
Oh.
Which is, sounds like a boring fact, but it was a good reminder that brown people need to wear sunscreen too.
That's right. You can't see us because this is an audio medium, but we are both brown and both evidence that you do need to wear sunscreen. This is a PSA for my dad because, you know, yes, I know that we are from the subtropics, but also skin cancer is real.
It is.
It is real. And I don't know, just, you know, It doesn't take that long. Just slip, slap, slop. Yeah. I think we need to bring back, actually, for adults, the hat with the neck flap.
Because definitely.
Yeah. I've been noticing lately, like, I've been very aware of the back of my neck and how hot the back of my neck is getting. I'm like,
Yep. Kind of don't think about it until it's, like, burning.
Yes, exactly. And then it's too late. So please make sure to be sun smart. Now, we have, as usual, a massive show for you today. Do you want to kick us off with what we've got on?
Yeah. So first, we're going to hear from Rasha Taya, a Palestinian artist, curator, herbalist, and founder of Beit El-Shai Tea House, who joined Inez to discuss the creation of Compost Compose, an arts project inviting artists to reflect on the purpose of art in times of ongoing genocide, social decay and climate crisis. Through a live performance weaving music, poetry and movement, the work responds to and asks how we might compost old structures, tend to grief and decomposed inherited ways of being to make space for new composing imaginaries rooted in care, repair and collective liberation. And you can actually see that live performance on Wednesday the 18th of February at 7 p.m. at Next Wave.
Awesome. And we'll have more information about how to get tickets and about the free public program running on the 21st of February in our show notes. And after that, we are going to hear a conversation between Wani Toishara and Hussein Abdirahman Mohammed with Inez to discuss the upcoming Through Our Eyes photography exhibition, which invites audiences into a living archive of African Australian experiences curated by returning guest Dr. Ibukun Olorontoba. The exhibition responds to the pressing need for self-representation and visibility for the African diaspora living in Australia, examining how experiences of love, belonging and resilience emerge in everyday life. And you can join them for their special opening night next Friday, the 13th of February at 6 p.m. at Black Dot Gallery. And we will again have information about how to get tickets in our show notes.
And then Priya is joined by Samantha Floriani, who is a digital justice advocate and writer, with work published in The Guardian, Overland, Kill Your Darlings and elsewhere. They're currently undertaking PhD research on the ways that digital technologies in so-called Australia's private rental sector impact renters and housing justice. And they join us today over the phone to discuss the rise in digital rent technology, things like apps to pay bills and chatbot support agents, and how, beyond the erosion of everyday functionality, they pose a distinct and demonstrable threat to privacy and security.
Yes, I'm looking at you, MePay. And after that, we are joined by Fiona York, Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group, who's discussing the Allen Labor government's announcement last week of plans to demolish seven older persons' public housing towers in the next stage of its high-rise redevelopment program. Now, this move will erase over half of Melbourne's dedicated high-rise public housing for people over the age of 55 and has understandably sparked concern and condemnation by grassroots groups in the community sector about the impact that relocation and estate redevelopment will have on elderly public tenants. So it will be great to have Fiona on to talk about this and also about the uniqueness of having dedicated public housing for older people. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And before we head to the news headlines, we just wanted to remind listeners that February is subscriber drive at 3CR.
Oh, yes.
Now, it's a little bit different to Radiothon, where Radiothon is a month where we are asking you for your donations. Subscriber Drive is actually a reminder to become a part of the 3CR community by buying a subscription to the station. So basically, it runs from Monday, the 9th of February, to Sunday, the 15th of February, but effectively the whole month. And it is a reminder that you become a part of the station. You can be involved in station governance. You can join some of our committees. We really want people who listen to the station to get involved in the station. This is for you. We care so much about our audience, and you are all a part of the 3CR community. So to subscribe, you can head to 3cr.org.au, and you can also choose to set up a recurring subscription online.
Yeah, that's right. And there are also concession rates. So it is sliding scale for those of you that are on lower incomes. And yeah, the money really goes back to you, the listeners, and to support our beautiful guests and contributors. We will be with you shortly, bringing you the news headlines for today.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:08 in the morning, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 5th of February. Lawyers for public housing tenants in North Melbourne and Flemington are today seeking a court injunction to stop Homes Victoria from evicting remaining residents, while an appeal in the class action over the demolition of their homes is pursued. Several dozen households remain in the three buildings after they declined relocation offers, and Homes Victoria is understood to be preparing to issue notices to vacate towards the end of the month. The Victorian Court of Appeal will be asked to grant an order restraining Homes Victoria from issuing these notices to vacate until an application for special leave to appeal is determined by the High Court. In other news, Israeli forces continue to violate the so-called ceasefire this week, killing at least 18 Palestinians across Gaza in the past few days and shelling camps of displaced people. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a young Palestinian man during a raid in Jericho. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said Israel abruptly cancelled all medical evacuations through the Rafah crossing yesterday, further endangering Palestinians who are wounded and critically ill as a result of Israel's ongoing blockade of Gaza. Israel has set up a new checkpoint called Regavim outside the Rafah crossing, a move analysts say signals a shift from temporary security control to West Bank-style population management and land grabs, with the name echoing Zionist ideology and the far-right Regavim movement. Also in news this week, thousands of protesters continue to mobilise nationwide around so-called Australia against the upcoming visit of Israeli President Isaac Herzog, with more protests planned in cities this weekend. Palestinian activists and advocates are urging the federal government to rescind the invitation, saying that this invitation amounts to complicity in Israel's genocide in Palestine. Some federal ministers have publicly opposed the visit, and New South Wales Labor backbenchers are planning to join demonstrations despite police bans on protests in Gadigal Land in Sydney.
Finally, in headlines this week, Recent reports by digital experts indicate rental platforms used by real estates in so-called Australia are leaving millions of documents with tenants' personal details exposed online. The research found lease agreements, identification documents, and payslips dating back to 2017 could be accessed without logins on several platforms. The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner said it had received no breach notifications from the platforms, but said rental technology and the growing demands for personal data in the sector are now a regulatory priority. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 5th of February. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
This is Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 12 minutes past 7 in the morning. Now, we're going to hear from Rasha Tayeh, a Palestinian artist, curator, herbalist, and founder of the Beit El Shai Tea House, who joined Inez to discuss the creation of Compost Compose, which is an arts project inviting artists to reflect on the purpose of art in times of ongoing genocide, social decay, and climate crisis. Through a live performance, which you can actually see on Wednesday, the 18th of February at Next Wave, the artist will be weaving music, poetry, and movement. The work responds to and asks how we might compost old structures, tend to grief, and decompose inherited ways of being to make space for new composing imaginaries rooted in care, repair, and collective liberation. The performance will be happening at 7 p.m. on Wednesday at 270 Sydney Road, Brunswick. Sliding scale tickets are available from $10. And there's also a free public program starting on Saturday, the 21st of February. Oh, sorry, it's actually for one day on Saturday, the 21st of February at 3 p.m., also at Next Wave on Sydney Road, and RSVP is essential. We'll include all of the details and the links for that in our show notes today. Here's Inez and Rasha Tayeh.
Thanks so much for joining us here today on 3CR Thursday Breakfast. How are you today, Rasha?
I'm really well. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, really honoured to have you and be able to talk about such an incredible project and event that's coming up now. I was just wondering if you could tell us, our listeners, a little bit more about you and the amazing work that you've been doing over the past few years.
Sure. So I trained as a photographer many moons ago, and visual arts, and then I've since also studied herbalism and nutrition, and at some point in my career I found myself kind of automatically blending the two practices of art and health, and that really informs my creative practice as a whole. I've also since starting my Beit El Shai Tea House, which is a pop-up space for arts and culture and tea ceremony and connection and workshops and all sorts of wonderful things that happen in community. I found myself curating a whole range of events over the last 8 years now, I think. I started it in 2017, so it's been quite a while. So yeah, my practice has kind of emerged in different ways. It's evolved in different ways. I come to curation as an artist, and I think that's definitely a strength. And there's a certain sensitivity and sensibility to curating or producing events whilst coming from an arts background, because you know, being an artist, you kind of also know what artists need, or at least, you know, try to, as opposed to coming to complete events management, removed from the reality of what's on the other side. So yeah, a whole range of things. Very, very, very concerned with land, and I find a lot of inspiration from what the land teaches us.
Yeah, it's really beautiful, and being able to look at how different artists need to be supported, how land needs to be supported, and the way that you're speaking and all the work that you've been doing, it just feels like it's really ingrained in your practice. And when it comes to composing and curating an event like this, how does that kind of start from conception to kind of being out into the public now to make sure it's like from the heart and well curated, do you think?
Sure. So I've come to this particular project as an artist first. So the project is called Compost Compose, and the work is actually stemmed from a very personal grief. And I started writing about compost and kind of just meditating with what's underground, probably since the 7th of October in 2023, and being Palestinian and being affected with what's happening in Palestine, you know, predating October 7th, obviously. But I think for this particular project, I was in a deep grief that I felt outside of my depth in. And one of the ways that I found myself naturally processing that grief was in my garden, and really tending to the soil and really tending to my compost and finding inspiration in a compost bin out of all places, because I felt like the world was crumbling all around me, and I still do, actually. So I think that kind of narrative or meaning making from looking at death and decay and rot, and how that can move underground as nutrients, and where there's so many different microorganisms involved in actually regenerating and rebirthing life underground. So for me, it sort of became like a bit of a prayer and a bit of a meditation to hang on to a little bit of sanity that's left in these crazy times, and really horrific times of ongoing genocide, of climate crisis, of social unraveling. And we're seeing a lot of crises happening at once around the world, not just in Palestine and not just on stolen land here. So the work has kind of come from that place, and I've been working on it on my own, hosting workshops, looking at hosting conversations that look at the metaphor and the materiality of compost and how people make meaning of grief, what questions might be asked of humanity, of people around, you know, what is the purpose of the arts in these times? It feels kind of arrogant sometimes to be an artist or philosophize about things when people's bodies are being shattered and people are dying or being killed horrifically. So, you know, I had a lot of questions, and you know, being personally impacted by what's happening in Palestine and the genocide in Gaza, more specifically, having lost relatives, this has been really like a project for me to stay somewhat connected to my own humanity and my own sanity, and also feel like I'm part of an ecosystem, even if it's just in my little garden, in my backyard, you know. I got to a point where I was traveling back and forth to Palestine over the last couple of years, and really focused on this work in art residencies, And also I traveled to Jordan, spent some time in Amman, and I felt really, obviously having, you know, personal and family connections to those parts of the world, but it felt like culturally that's where I needed to be, spiritually that's where I needed to be. And these were the kinds of conversations I needed to be having without the censorship that we find here in the colony. So bringing the project here and now opening up and inviting other artists to join in this conversation has felt really necessary, because sometimes when you work on something for a couple of years on your own and you're sort of like in a very lonely place with it, I think, you know, I'm ready to also open up that space for a dialogue, because really, like, who the hell am I to only just be sort of ushering conversations like this on my own, when really the work is about collectivity, it is about community, it is about other people. So it felt really exciting to open up this space within the framework of emerging curatorial kind of program in partnership with Next Wave and Blindside. And I sort of jumped on that bandwagon and then invited artists through an open call to basically compose. So I was really focusing on the compose element of the compost compose, and they're performance-based artists. There's poets and musicians and movement based artists and wonderful people who, yeah, who are kind of joining in this storytelling, and where to next.
It's so special and so important to, and hearing you speak about the importance of collectivity and regenerative practice and how bringing in people to something, I'm sure would be really exciting after having you have been thinking about this for a long time. And before I ask you a little bit more about the event, you touched on really important aspects of the purpose of art during this time and relating it to compost as well, just because you do have to like care for it, you have to repair it, you have to bring it together, and really believe in it. And I'm wondering how art has been a solace for you, and similarly with composting. Is that a practice, or do you enjoy looking at it every day? What is that like for you?
I think being a gardener, there's always been a lot of concern with soil health, and also, just looking at the plant's life cycle. You know, there's so much food all around us. There's so much energy all around us, and there's also a lot of waste.
Yeah.
So it's also about how we deal with the waste and with those kinds of processes around decay and rot and the things that are really uncomfortable. I guess for me, looking at the unpleasant, you know, the things that we don't want to look at, it's important. It's because life is not, you know, life is messy, life is full of the beauty, but also full of the ugly. And I think you can't take one without the other. So I think for me, this process of slowing down and really noticing everything, not just the beautiful things, but the real rotten things that do have, you know, purpose and do have meaning. And there's a necessary process there of transmuting energy from things that are dying and moving them towards life force. So for me, it's kind of like trying to make meaning out of all this madness that we see in the world, and, you know, trying to find inspiration from little tiny organisms or garden worms or mycelial networks, and understanding how mushrooms work and all of these decomposers or composters that naturally change or transmute energy from one form to the next. And I think that's a really powerful thing. And I think those organisms and are more than human kin. We have so much to learn from. You know, I think there's a certain arrogance in human beings, And if we actually look to other living beings within an ecosystem, we have so much to learn.
Yeah, beautiful. And thinking about the ecosystem and the different parts that are also in this program, what kind of artists are involved in this program? And yeah, what can people expect throughout it?
Sure. So the project is made up of two events. The main event is a live performance on Wednesday, the 18th of February. The artists involved there are Alara, a staunch Yorta Yorta artist, songwoman, bassist, and sound designer and producer, as well as Mohammed Shamas, and they are a poet and new media artist, and also Yusuke Akai, who's a guitarist and drummer and a composer. So the three artists will be performing on Wednesday, the 18th of February. And then on the Saturday of that week, the 21st of February, there's a public program artist talk with the artists I just mentioned, as well as short performances from Sara Iman, who is an actor and a movement artist, as well as a poet. Also Mwafa El Hajar, who's a poet and a performer, and also DT, who's a Aboriginal cultural dancer and hip hop artist. So there'll be short performances prior to the artist talk, and then all six artists will be invited to have a conversation with me around the purpose of the arts in times of genocide and social unraveling and climate crisis. And I think these are conversations that aren't being had enough, or at least not in public forums, as far as I'm aware, here in NAM.
Yeah, it sounds so beautiful and so special. And just reminding people again that it is the Wednesday 18th of February at Next Wave in Brunswick at 7 p.m. and then Saturday the 21st of February at 3 p.m. also at Next Wave in Brunswick. And for, you know, you're putting on this incredible, you know, two-part event. You've created it, there's artists coming, but so much of that is also dependent on having a respectful, participatory, engaged audience. But what would you like for people to, I guess, bring into the space or, reflect on before they attend?
Bring a lot of curiosity. I think that's really important, and an open heart and an open mind. I think these are really important elements to bring into spaces like this. I don't want to really give away too much of the show because it's very exciting and,
yes,
and
of course,
we're working really hard, but that there'll be a lot of beauty shared and a lot of vulnerability shared and a lot of, you know, beautiful words and music. Just come and enjoy, come and, you know, just be open to experiencing the magic that these wonderful, talented artists have to offer and share. And it's a very generous offering from all of them. So I'm really excited to see what they present. And also I should mention that the Wednesday show, the live performance with Alara, Mohammed and Yusuke, that's a ticketed show, and tickets can be found on nextwave.org.au/whatson. And there's a sliding scale, and also tickets are free to our First Nations friends. And the Saturday public program is free to attend, but it's in a smaller studio space, so we do need to cap it. And so you'll just need to RSVP. So that one is free to attend, but just register your name to join in the conversation for the artist talk on the Saturday.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much. This is such an exciting and really important event, and I can't wait for our listeners to show up and share with their friends. So just a reminder, that's Wednesday the 18th of February at 7 p.m. That's tickets from Sliding Scale at Next Wave in Brunswick. And then Saturday the 21st of February at 3 p.m. It will be free, but you'll RSVP, and we'll have all of that in our show notes as well. But thank you so much, Rasha, for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much. Appreciate you.
Bye.
Bye.
You just heard our co-host, Inez, in conversation with Rasha Tayer, a Palestinian artist, curator and herbalist and founder of Beit Eshai Tea House, who joined Thursday Breakfast to discuss the creation of Compost Compose. And you can see their performance live on Wednesday, the 18th of February, 7 p.m. at Next Wave on Sydney Road. And we'll include all the details for that in our show notes today. And next, we are going to hear another conversation with Inez. And Priya, would you like to tell us what it's going to be about?
Yes, Inez has lined up some incredible interviews this week looking at performances and events coming up in the next few weeks. So this next interview is with Wani Toishara, who's the co-curator of this next event, and Hussein Abdirahman Mohammed, who's one of the artists. And they spoke with Inez about the upcoming Through Our Eyes photography exhibition, which invites audiences into a living archive of African Australian experiences curated by returning guest Dr. Ibukun Olorontoba. This exhibition responds to the pressing need for self-representation and visibility for the African diaspora living in Australia, examining how experiences of love, belonging, and resilience emerge in everyday life. Each artist's work investigates love as a connective force, whether through the quiet intimacies of brotherhood, the collective sanctuary of community, or the resilience nurtured in and beyond public housing estates.
I'm wondering if maybe we can start off with you, Wani, of what you do with your art practice, and you could introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners.
For sure. So my name is Wani Toishara. I'm an art practitioner. My art practice mostly centers around navigating being diaspora, specifically African, Black diaspora, what that looks like, making place and belonging, especially making place somewhere where is not home to you, and somewhere where also, where you're displaced. And trying to figure what that means also on someone else's land. And so my art mainly looks at that and the in-betweens, and it blends photography, videography, and different image making. It began as performance, specifically spoken word poetry, and stage performance. I've done theater and whatnot. And right now I'm also moving into curating, which I've realized I'm growing a deep love for. So that's how I find myself here.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And what about you, Hussein?
Thank you for having us. This my photography is a way of coming to terms with my surroundings, making sense of the world around me. It's also I use it as a discovery as well. Sometimes blind engagement, and to see what comes out of it in the process of outputting work or seeing the images. I guess I think producing further knowledge into what it was that I was engaging to begin with. So I guess work in terms of photography in different domains. I do projects as a way of exploring certain topics, and I do a kind of photography that's also every day wherever I am. So it's something I see as a lifetime thing. And it started off with that curiosity of the people around me as a kid, just taking portraits of people who work in the park or rangers or something, and talking to someone that you normally would be scared of to speak to, and then it evolved into what it is today. I guess I would say it's a way of making sense of things to myself,
Yeah, that's really beautiful, especially with making sense of things that are surrounding, and so much of what you spoke about seems to be like a relationship between like trust between the photographer and the subject and the people around you. How do you think photography is kind of helped you build that relationship with the nature or the people around you? Like you said, it helps maybe talk to somebody that you weren't always used to.
To me, it brings something extra to an interaction. Like the photographic process is alienating both to the photographer and to the person being photographed. It requires explanation, and I think in that sense, it illuminates something more about the interaction, because especially for this particular project, working with the with my with my community, Somali community here in Melbourne, it was a process of interrogation, I guess, like me interrogating myself and then interrogating what it is that I'm after, and in that sense, it can give a structure to an interaction, but at the same time, it suspends what that is to a later date. So it makes room for a further engagement. Yeah. So if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much. And for yourself, Wadi, when you think about curation and photography compared to all the other modes that of art and practice that you've engaged with, what has made like this experience stand out or meaningful for you?
I think the people I'm getting to work with has been really exciting, because I didn't realize it until, I suppose, I got into the project, but I've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
And and I guess, like, thinking back to like the early days of, like, getting into visual arts practice, or just arts practice in general, and how rare it was to see like folks from my community like practicing, or like even kind of knowing spaces to be able to practice, to like, yeah, getting to a place where I could be like, yeah, I've been doing this for over a decade. And seeing like all these multiple ways of expression, I think for me that was really exciting, and meaningful, because it feels like collectively we're building a practice that's standing on each other, and I think that's exciting. And then also not just in like a representational sort of way, but more also like, I couldn't believe the caliber of and quality of all the artists' practice. I think that was really exhilarating, and yeah, and I guess inspiring for me, because yeah, to kind of see, both what's possible and what's coming, and what everybody's working with, and the different directions people take it from. I think that's probably, those are some of the most exciting things for me as a curator,
Yeah, beautiful.
or as one of the curators. Yeah.
Yes, and we've spoken to Awuken on the on a different exhibition that they had on the Immigration Museum, which is really beautiful. And to know that you've both worked together to curate this amazing exhibition that's coming up in about 2 weeks. And I know that each work kind of investigates love as a connective force, but could you talk a little bit about the exhibition and how it came together?
Yeah, sure. Hopefully I can do it some justice. But so from actually, maybe the better person to talk about is probably Hussein, because
Sure.
yeah, he was one of I came on to it towards the tail end of the project, so there's a way I got in, but I think Hussein might have a better entry point than I have, so.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, Hussein, would you like to talk about the exhibition?
On the point that that I was saying before, working with the curator, and in this project working with Wani and Ibukun, for me, what's added another layer to the process, one that sort of replicates the relationship that forms between the subject and the photographer to begin with, because here you have another layer of curation where your work is now speaking to another person. I guess the way for me, the way I made sense of this project was an opportunity to collaborate with other people of other photographers, particularly ones of similar interest and background, where there was there was an assumed understanding of what we were exploring, and it unfolded in a way that is that it was planned at the start, but it unfolded in a way that we were engaging in something also unknown that was unfolding in the process. So in that sense, it was the language of love here is that return to community and to look at things from because the okay so what I would say for me is like an opportunity I probably would have taken much longer to produce any work about the community if I wasn't working with this particular group, collaborators and curators, because there would have been a lot of things that needed to be pinned down and explained. But here there was like the this there was an element of trust and an element of trust that then get explored through each one of us through their respective communities, I guess. And yeah, so I guess those are the those broad themes that the project has engaged in was just elements of care and exploration of what could at times be sensitive topics or private communities, and if that was possible, and yeah, and I think that has been what this I don't know if that answers the question, but that's sort of the things that the project touched on for me.
Yep. And then when the exhibition is through our eyes and you're seeing all these wonderful photographers coming together, how have you personally also like selected your work? Like, were you given the prompt through our eyes and then took a bunch of photos, or you had really specific things in mind?
The one you can speak to the final selection, but in terms of what we each brought to the project, I think we had I had and I think others did as well, things that they were interested in and were working towards already, which sort of aligned with the proposal that Ibukun gave us to join in a collaborative project. So we expanded and continued with those with the things that we were already doing.
Yeah, Wally, did you want to speak to that a little bit more?
I suppose like generally to encompass everything is, what does love look like for you, I guess. And also like I think they were all already practicing artists, and we're really curious what like collectively their works could look like, given a prompt and given time to be able to like work on their own respective practices. And then yeah, Ibukun and I sat down and thought through, without giving too much away, thought through I guess the theme, and we looked at the works and spent a lot of time with the works, spent a lot of time talking to the different artists, both together and separately, and so ended up making a selection of, or a final selection of different works that we felt spoke to each other, and not just to each other in the sense of like one singular artist speaking, whose works are speaking to themselves, but as in like each artist speaking in each artist's work in conversation with the other artists and yeah, thinkers' works. So that's kind of how we came about the final selection.
Yeah, lovely. And so much, I know we've spoken about the photographer and the subject, and now it's also when it's coming up to opening night, it's about the photographer's work and the audience too. And what would you, I guess, like our listeners to know, to come into the space with, or like what to expect and how to participate in that space respectfully.
Yeah, I think like come in with an open mind and an open heart and kind of just be open to receive and see how you flow through that space, see what moves for you. One of the things we're hoping to do is we're hoping it to be the type of interactive experience that like doesn't need a lot of words. So you're not going to read a lot of text under the images. It's just going to be time for you to kind of sit with the images and potentially engage the artists if you're there on opening night, ask some questions and just kind of be in the space and see what it feels like for you.
Nice. And then I also with how to I guess curate that or architecture that do you have like places to sit down more and think, or how do you move through the space as well?
We're really blessed that we're able to do it through Black Dot, who have incredible curators of their own. In both Kimber and Catherine. And so they've supported us through thinking through the space as well quite a bit. And Ibukun and I have moved through so many other different galleries as well, thinking through movement. So there's definitely place to sit down. On opening night, you're going to get to hear music, dance if you want to. They're gonna have DJs, and also the cool thing is it's sort of a double opening, so it's not just the opening for Through Our Eyes, but there's another incredible artist in the gallery next to us with their own opening as well. So it'll be a fun night, and I'm like an introvert myself, so I always need spaces that I could kind of be, so there's lots of those, like,
okay. It sounds really special and really thoughtful. And for yourself, you say, what would you want the audiences to bring in when interacting with the space?
I think Wani said it best. I guess it's come in with open hearts and with the possibility to content with your own assumptions and so on, and to really look at the photos without all the tech accompanying text or being like or without us trying to attempt to fix what you will see. I don't know. This is one of my first exhibitions, so I don't really know what to expect. I hope everything falls into the right place, and we'll see. I'm actually looking forward to what people think about it and who will show up. I guess I don't really know what to expect, but I hope they will try to see how these works speak to each other and how each artist's presentation speaks to itself. I guess that's all I can ask for.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Very exciting. And just to wrap up, how can people join? I know that it is opening night on the 13th of February at Black Dot Gallery, which is 33 Saxon Street, Brunswick, and we'll have that in our show notes as well. But how can people join, learn more about the exhibition as well?
So they can find details on the Black Dot website, or if you happen to be in different areas, Hussein's actually just released a pretty incredible zine that's available at CCP that you can check out some of his work. And as always, you could kind of follow each individual artist. They all got cool practices and are available through Instagram.
Yep.
And all the other socials. So, you could check them out there.
Yep. And that is Black Dot Gallery, BLAKDOT. Mm-hmm. And that's 33 Saxon Street. Opening night is, once again, on the 13th of February, and it's running until March 8th. Yeah, lovely. We'll put that all in our show notes as well. But thank you so much for having such an open heart and mind and thoughtfulness with your practice in the exhibition. And I can't wait for our listeners to be there and to show up on opening night.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:50 in the morning. And you just heard a conversation between Inez and curator and artist Wani Toeshara and artist Hussein Abdirahman Mohammed, who spoke about the upcoming Through Our Eyes photography exhibition, which invites audiences into a living archive of African-Australian experiences and is curated by returning guest Dr. Ibukun Olorontoba. And as you just heard, the opening night is going to be next Friday, the 13th of February at Black Dot Gallery in Brunswick. And we will have information about how to attend that event and to visit the exhibition in our show notes.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
All right. Well, this is an interview that I am pretty excited about. As listeners know, I've been following stuff in the housing space for a while. And also, as listeners probably know, because I can imagine a good proportion of you are renters, there is an increasing encroachment on the privacy of renters in the Australian housing market, where we're being forced to give over more and more of our data, more and more of our information in, you know, quite coercive ways to prop tech companies in the process of trying to secure rentals. So now we are joined by Samantha Floriani, who's a digital justice advocate and writer, who is currently undertaking PhD research on the ways that digital technologies in so-called Australia's private rental sector impacts renters and housing justice. And Samantha is speaking with us today about the rise in digital rent technology. So this is things like apps to pay bills and chatbot support agents, and how beyond the erosion of everyday functionality, they pose a distinct demonstrable threat to renters' privacy and security in an already highly unequal housing market. Good morning, Samantha.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. What an intro.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, it is, it's compelling. Everybody has a take on housing and a stake in the housing question, right?
Absolutely. And I think renters really feel the brunt of that, particularly acutely often, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also is worth talking about the fact that, you know, the power imbalances within the housing sector really structure this conversation. You know, the ability to extract this information from renters is what facilitates, you know, the development of technologies to further yeah, like pick away at the privacy of people that are just trying to secure housing. Now, you were on the research team for a recently released report by the Australasian Housing and Urban Research Institute called The Implications of Tenant Data Collection in Housing, Protecting Australian Renters. And that was published late last month. I was wondering if, you know, based on that report and your own research, can you give us a general idea of the scale of prop tech use in the Australian rental sector? And is this just restricted to private renters?
Yeah, great. Great question. Okay, so the there's a really sprawling network of prop tech is what it's called. So property technology, that's what it stands for. That's a huge area of technology that intersects with all kinds of property, not just residential. And then sort of a subset of that is rent tech, or I like to call it landlord tech, because I think it really names who it ultimately serves. And so that's a smaller subset. In my research, I've looked at about just over 60 different products that renters interact with knowingly or not. So we're talking about things like online application platforms, online listing platforms, rent payment apps, property management portals where you might communicate with your property manager or log maintenance requests and so on. And all of these things kind of fit together and attempt to integrate with each other in a kind of complex information ecosystem. And some of them renters will interact with knowingly, like you'll sort of download an app or you'll be pushed to, you know, go to a website or whatever. And others happen are used behind the scenes. So things like CRMs and other forms of automation that property managers use and so on. So it's pretty widespread. And it's not just in the private rental sector. There are also all kinds of digital technologies that are used for social housing as well. Mm. That's not really my area of focus, but it is something that was covered off in the Ahuri report. And in our examination, we found quite a lot of issues. They're not all negative. Like, there are some potential positives, and, you know, people do experience sometimes some level of convenience. I haven't encountered many people who really want to go back to the days of filling out paper forms. but it does come with, you know, depending how these things are set up, and as you mentioned, because of the power imbalance that's sort of characteristic of being a renter or being in social or public housing, that this can lead to all kinds of issues. So some of the things we raised in the report and some of the things that I focus on in my PhD are things like, as you mentioned, privacy, data security, issues around platform surveillance, potential to discriminate through automated decision-making systems. So if you think, for example, you know, when you're applying for a rental and you hand over all this information, like, how is the decision being made about who gets that rental and how does your data sort of impact that? So it's a really, like, sort of juicy area with lots of problems, lots of challenges. But also, I think, you know, I try to remain a bit positive, so it's not all doom and gloom. I think there is, like, potential for technology to be useful in this space. And the last thing I'll say on it is that one of the things that I've really enjoyed looking at in my PhD is talking with renters who are attempting to use technology in ways that are kind of subversive, in ways that challenge the power imbalance between renters and agents and landlords. And, you know, and advocates like, you know, Jordan Vandenlam or Purple Pingers, for example, and other, you know, tenants unions and housing organizations that are using tech in innovative ways to try to, like, shake things up. So, you know, it's not all nightmares.
Yes, exactly. There is some, I guess, counter surveillance work being done through the Shit Rentals platform, and yeah, various other, like, peer information sharing about, you know, things like terrible quality issues or treatment by particular real estate agencies. But we're sticking on the doom and gloom for this conversation. And on Monday, The Guardian reported some serious security vulnerabilities across 7 major rent tech platforms, including tenant data privacy breaches. Now, when there's a million different third parties involved in you trying to secure a rental, I'm wondering about the extent of these vulnerabilities and the implications that they have for people who are forced to use these services in the process of trying to secure a rental.
Yeah, and it's really challenging to be able to fully understand the extent of these vulnerabilities, right? So in that news, it was found that there were serious vulnerabilities across 7 different popular, commonly used platforms. They're not named mainly because a lot of the vulnerabilities are still live, and so we don't really want to make the situation worse by alerting malicious actors to their existence. But I think what it does show, given that it's across 7 different platforms, and these were vulnerabilities that were trivially easy to find, like if they had put in pretty basic security protections, they wouldn't have been found. I think it can hint to us of a larger issue across the sector in terms of, you know, reasonable and appropriate digital security protections being put in place, and also just like issues around privacy as well, in terms of how much personal information is being collected, how long it's being stored for, how it's being stored, who it's being shared with. And that is just really hard to get a firm grasp of. I mean, I've spent you know, more than my fair share of time looking at privacy policies and trying to understand connections and integrations between these companies. And even still, it's really hard to sort of get a clear picture. So if you're an everyday renter dealing with, you know, then this is not your focus of your PhD and you're dealing with, you know, other things in your life. If you're trying to figure out, like, okay, I have to give over this information because I need to, you know, apply for a rental and there's no other way to go about it. You know, if I'm choosing between finding somewhere to live and my privacy concerns, I think most people are like, well, housing comes first. Mm. And so you're pushed into doing this. And then if you look at like, if you're curious and you're like, okay, what's happening with my data? It's extremely hard to figure out what is happening with it. And this is made more complicated by sort of a bit of a patchwork of legislation. So it depends on which state you live in. Some states, in their residential tenancies legislation, they have some protections for renter personal information. This is slowly improving in some states. For example, in New South Wales and in Victoria, they have made some reforms in this space to make it a little bit better. But if you're in a different state, it'll be different. And then, of course, there's the Privacy Act. So your RTA, the Residential Tenancies Act, that will cover that your real estate agent, right? But the technology companies, they to varying degrees are covered by the Privacy Act. Some real estate agents are covered by the Privacy Act, but most aren't. Mm. And so you end up with this very sort of, if you're a renter and you want to do something about it, even figuring out where to go or what protections you're even afforded is really challenging. And I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah. And I guess it's, you know, compounded by a system which still very much puts the onus on renters to prove that there are various problems in attempting to, you know, establish a tenancy or within the life of a tenancy. You know, if that burden of proof is still on the renter and it's very difficult to find out where the information is sharing, what legislation applies, I can imagine it gets pretty murky. And I also wanted to touch on something, you know, coming back to that power imbalance. There is also a lot of, I guess, promotion of voluntary disclosure of information that feels mandatory across these applications, right? People are not necessarily sure about you know, what questions are non-negotiables, even if, you know, there are some things you have to say and some things you don't have to say. But sometimes, you know, the risk of over-disclosing unnecessarily is real if you're really trying to secure a rental tenancy and you're competing with so many other applicants.
Absolutely. And I think it's so spot on and it's a point well made because, I mean, if you're applying online, many of these platforms will push you, will sort of nudge you towards providing additional information, and they'll do so by saying things like, you know, show you're a great tenant, like, and that, you know, if you're, as we all are, living under a housing crisis, the rental market is extremely tight. You've probably gone to an inspection and there were like 40 or 50 other people. I certainly have, and it's pretty demoralizing. So then you've got in your mind like, okay, well, I really need to, like, you know, quote unquote, put my best foot forward to have a good chance at this. So and they know that, right? Mm. And so they sort of nudge you towards providing additional pieces of information that aren't mandatory, and that sort of go more into this kind of, like, you know, performance of being the you know, the good tenant, you know, the quote unquote good tenant. The other thing is, as well, is that, you know, there's often some forced disclosure that happens for people who are living with disabilities, or if they are on receiving some sort of you know, government support payment. Mm. Even though these portals often won't explicitly ask things like that, they're not allowed to explicitly ask, for example, if you have a disability, but because you have to upload, you know, evidence of payments, for example, people in those positions are sort of forced to make themselves visible to these systems, even if they don't want to.
Mm. Yeah, and it's, you know, and you're relying on the goodwill of the assessor, but then, you know, we don't know about the extent to which this assessment is automated, and where people, you know, the variables that are used to calculate who might be a successful tenant versus an undesirable tenant is, yeah, extremely opaque. Now, just wrapping up, I wanted to ask, what can be done about this situation? Are there any international best practice examples of prop tech regulation? And then I guess an addendum to that question is, you know, to what extent can regulatory reform actually attend to that power imbalance we've been talking about between renters and property owners?
Yeah, I think that power imbalance is really tricky to address. I do think at least there needs to be a shift. You mentioned before how the onus is on the renter to basically enforce their own rights. I think we need to see that shift dramatically. You know, it shouldn't be up to renters to have to enforce that on their own. So that would be somewhere to start, at least. Obviously, addressing bigger picture issues in the housing system would also help to shift the power imbalance. But that's probably a very long-term project. In terms of the prop tech and rent tech stuff, you know, there are some small movements. I'm not familiar of anything that's like, you know, what we should be reaching for. I mean, you know, for example, if we look to the US, they're living in a sort of a different kind of nightmare where you have major, like, commercial landlords who are operating their technologies at a scale that are quite different to here, where it's, you know, we've still got that sort of classic, you know, mum and dad landlord kind of situation. Mm. So the landscapes are kind of different. Something that I think is quite cool in Scotland, they have a mandatory landlord register where you have to apply to become a landlord and demonstrate that you're, you know, meeting your requirements. That's not quite like regulating prop tech, but I do think it goes some way in addressing some of the information asymmetries that are present in this. Because that's the other thing, right? There's so much information about renters being collected, and the same is not happening for landlords. So there's some work to be done in terms of addressing that information asymmetry as well, which I think is linked to the power imbalance.
Yeah. Well. Oh, go on.
No, I was going to say, I'm sorry I don't have a more like, you know, a gold star thing to like work towards. But I think, you know, Australian policymakers have expressed interest in this space. So, and there are a lot of people working on it. So I'm at least somewhat hopeful that we might see a little bit more movement. And I know that the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner is also looking into rent tech and the real estate sector. So, who knows? Stay tuned.
Yes, fingers crossed. And I mean, I guess, you know, part of the status quo situation that we have right now is to be expected when there has been such, you know, sort of like rampant tech optimism and I guess, you know, compounded by treatment of housing as an asset. It's all about trying to, you know, maximize returns on investment in property. So until we see some of those fundamental power imbalances shift, I think we've got quite a ways to go. But look, Samantha, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And we'll have links in our show note to that Uhuru report as well as to your own site so people can look at the research you're doing.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. And that was Samantha Floriani, who's a digital justice advocate and writer, as well as a PhD researcher looking at the ways that digital technologies in so-called Australia's rental sector impact issues of renting and housing justice. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And if you are just joining us, we also heard from Rasha Taieh, Palestinian artist, curator, herbalist, and founder of the Bet Ishai Tea House, and also from Wani Toishara and Hussein Abdi Rahman Muhammad about the upcoming Through Our Eyes photography exhibition. It is 8:09 in the morning.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, anikalegal@www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are coming up to our final interview for the show today. We're joined by Fiona York, Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group, who is speaking with us about the Allan Labor government's announcement last week of plans to demolish seven older persons' public housing towers in the next stage of its high-rise redevelopment program. Now, this move will erase over half of Melbourne's dedicated high-rise public housing for people over the age of 55 years, sparking concern and condemnation by grassroots groups in the community sector about the impacts that relocation and estate redevelopment will have on elderly public tenants. While 13 older persons' towers are included in the overall high-rise redevelopment program, tenants and advocates were led to believe that these buildings would not be up for demolition until significantly later in the program. Good morning, Fiona. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Priya.
So I guess we should jump straight into it. Not only was this an unexpectedly early announcement, but missing in the government's own media release was the mention of the fact that these buildings are dedicated older persons' public housing. Can you start off by telling us about what makes the older persons' high-rises unique?
So we're really lucky in Victoria to have a recognition of the needs of older tenants. In the system that is called the Victorian Housing Register, which is basically the wait list for public housing and community housing, there's a recognition of 55-plus people being a priority category, and there's also dedicated housing for 55 years and older. So as you mentioned in your intro there, there's 13 towers that are dedicated to 55-plus housing, and there's also a lot of low-rise housing and two- and three-storey dedicated older people's housing as well. So we think it's a really important part of the housing mix in Victoria. When we go interstate and we tell housing advocates about this, they're really envious of it. They understand that this is a unique part of Victoria's housing program. And for our clients that we help to move into these places, they report a feeling of safety and security. The rent is set at 25% of their income, and they feel very supported by the public housing system. So we would really like to see that retained, and we think it's a really important place for older people, certainly a lot better than struggling in private rental, and we think it's a very important part for older people to have somewhere safe to live as they get older.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fact that there's assumed longevity of tenure in public housing was also something that provided that sense of security. But, you know, it appears that quite a few residents and community organizations in this case have been led to believe that these towers would be scheduled for redevelopment much later in the program. And this had functioned as a reassurance for some elderly tenants who didn't feel they would be able to cope with such a significant disruption. So how has last week's decision landed with the older tenants in these towers?
Yeah, we certainly did have that impression that the older person's towers wouldn't be this quickly on the schedule of the redevelopment. And certainly when we first heard about the redevelopment and we were talking to tenants, people were saying, well, that's not going to affect me, that's not going to happen in my lifetime. It's years down the track. We're talking about people in their 80s and 90s in some cases. And so obviously something that's going to be happening in 2040 isn't probably going to affect them. So they did have that sense that it wouldn't be their issue, I guess. So there's been a range of responses from what we've heard. We've heard a bit of confusion around who's going to go where and how that's going to happen, and I guess misinterpreting the offer of relocations and what that might mean for people and where they're going to go. There's certainly concerns about the tenure, whether or not they'll have the same rights and things underneath the community housing model. We understand there's efforts to keep people in the communities that they're living in, which is a step forward. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of concern about the process and the disruption and what the future of the support systems will be when older tenants will just be in the general housing as well. They won't be as visible, and the supports will be harder to access is our concern. So, yeah, range of responses from the tenants, a fair bit of confusion out there.
Actually, on that support, there are a set of dedicated state-funded supports that are associated with the older person's high-rises now, including the older person's high-rise program. Has there been any indication that this kind of structured support program will be continued to be provided to tenants if they leave the older person's buildings?
We haven't had any confirmation of that. It's definitely a live discussion at the moment with government, and we're hoping that those programs will continue in the future. But how that's going to work and what that will look like and who will be delivering that support, we don't know. And I think there's a bit of a perception out there that there's some sort of well-running, smooth aged care system that will step in to assist people. And we know from our work in the aged care sector and trying to connect people with aged care support that that's not the case. It's even more complicated and convoluted than the housing system, which is hard to believe. There really is a lot of barriers for older people to be accessing this Commonwealth-funded aged care, and so we think that there will still require a state support system for people, older tenants.
I'm also thinking about the co-location of a lot of older people in, you know, similar age cohort, potentially, you know, having a protective impact, you being around peers from the same age cohort. So I wanted to ask about how issues such as community dispersal as well as relocation are compounded for older public renters and the consequences that you anticipate this latest redevelopment announcement is going to have for older tenants.
Yeah, we're really concerned about the impact on older renters for moving. We know a lot of people like public housing because it's, as we say often in the organisation, it's home until stumps. It's somewhere you can be for, you know, as long as you need to be. So the disruption itself, as well as the logistics of that, is a big concern for us, especially with people that have got compounding age-related, you know, chronic health conditions. It is going to be quite a problem for a lot of people. The community supports and I guess the visibility of older tenants in dedicated 55-plus public housing is an advantage, and we certainly saw that in COVID where we could see and we knew where people were to be able to provide health supports, and that's what we're at risk of losing by dispersing people into the general kind of community and public housing sector. Mm. So, yeah, I think it is really important to recognise that lots of people have lived here 15, 20 years in these estates. They know their neighbours, they feel safe, they have support people that they can call upon, and it is that really important thing for ageing well is being able to be connected with community. And social isolation, as we know, is a real issue as well. So those are the things that we're hoping the government is going to be prioritising in this program, that the health needs and the wellbeing and the social connections can be maintained, as well as providing a lot more additional support for the logistics of the move, which is much, much harder when you're older.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about that. The Guardian headline from last week where an older tenant was saying, I can't move a fridge. And I think, you know, these are the practicalities of the way that these kinds of announcements disrupt people's lives and, you know, cause such an immense amount of stress for older folks who, many of whom would have reasonably believed that they would be able to, you know, live out the rest of their lives in the place that they are living right now.
And I mean, one of the problems that we're seeing, as well as the people that have lived there for 15 odd years, there's people that have moved in even recently in the last couple of months. So that's a big issue as well. Yeah. Like they thought that they had a forever home. They've been homeless or living in unaffordable private rental, and now all of a sudden they have to move again. So that's another thing too, is the disruption for people that have just moved in there.
Absolutely. That is a really good point. And I guess finally, I was hoping to get your perspective on the Allan Labor government's announcement. In that same media release about this next tranche of towers for redevelopment, that it's launching the Hand-in-Hand Community Support Program, which it's described as a peer support initiative, which will, quote, offer support, information and reassurance to residents during the relocation process, end quote. So why this approach and why now, considering that this is now the third tranche of buildings that has been announced?
We have no detail about what that program's going to look like yet, unfortunately, so it's hard to comment. I think it's a recognition that older people do need more support, which is good, but what we don't want to see is that tenants, volunteers, hopefully there won't be volunteers, but the peer support workers are having to do the work that should be getting done by paid professionals that have got, you know, social work skills or skills and being able to deal with quite difficult conversations with people. So absolutely, they're supportive of a peer support model, but that needs to be adequately supported, and there still needs to be dedicated, skilled, experienced relocation support that's outside. We should also say independent of Homes Victoria, because they're the landlords, effectively. So people need support that's independent and skilled, and yes, peers for sure, but also, in addition, these are going to be hard conversations with people, and it's going to be very difficult to be having to answer the unknown questions as well. So we'll wait and see on the details for that. But I do think there has been a recognition that we do need more support for older people.
Yes, absolutely.
What that looks like, who knows yet?
Yes, and you know, your mention of the importance of being independent, but also adequately resourced is vital. Look, thanks so much, Fiona. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, I think it's going to be a long haul, and I just urge people to, you know, get out there and defend public housing, because we are genuinely concerned that we are losing important public housing in Victoria. So to all the listeners out there, just keep an eye on it. It's not going away anytime soon.
For sure. Look, thanks so much, Fiona, and hope to have you back on the show soon.
Thanks, Priya.
And that was Fiona York, Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group, who spoke with us about the Allan Labor government's announcement last week of its plans to demolish 7 out of the 13 older persons public housing high-rise towers in the next stage of its high-rise redevelopment program. You can read Housing for the Aged Action Group's statement in our show notes. And you can also catch Fiona and the HAG crew on 3CR's Raise the Roof program every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English, so
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio Filef.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:25 in the morning. Now, we did get a live listener message from a listener who let us know that they'd heard from an older gentleman in a low-rise building in St. Kilda that they were notified on Friday that their building would be up for demolition as well. I guess the important thing to bear in mind for listeners is that, you know, the high-rise redevelopment program is sort of the new initiative that has been badged by the Victorian state government in public housing redevelopment, but there's also a bunch of parallel initiatives that are still going on under the big housing build. So quick recap of history. There's the introduction of the public housing renewal program, which then became the big housing build. That's where the ground lease model was introduced. And so we've got this this redevelopment of estates that's been happening in a more systematic way over, let's say, the past decade in Victoria. And that is estates that have mainly been walk-ups, low-rise estates. So thinking about Ascot Vale, Barrack Beacon, where there've been, you know, big public fights to try and resist those redevelopments and get the government to think about a different way to approach public housing. And, you know, thinking about retrofit instead of demolition. You know, that approach has also been tried in relation to the towers. And I've been involved in, you know, research and supporting reports at looking at these approaches and looking at the impacts that it has on tenants. But I guess the fact is that there are multiple processes happening at the same time. So I definitely don't doubt that that gentleman is being affected by an ongoing process of public housing estate renewal that isn't just affecting the towers. There's a lot of people across the state who are being impacted by public housing renewal. It just so happens that the towers are the most prominent thing in our collective vision at the moment. But thanks so much for calling in. And like, please do feel free to call in and leave any messages for the Thursday Breakfast crew about anything, including our housing coverage, on 0394198377 during business hours. Now, we're coming up to the end of our show. Do you want to kick off the rundown, Leela?
Yeah, so two reminders. One that we got from you earlier, Priya, that it is subscriber drive. So please think about subscribing if you are a regular listener. We want to keep content coming to you. And yeah, it would really help. So first up today, we heard from Rasha Tayeh, a Palestinian artist, curator and herbalist, and the founder of Beit Eshai Tea House, who joined Inez to discuss their upcoming exhibition, Compost Compose, which is an arts project inviting people to reflect on the purpose of art in times of ongoing genocide, social decay and climate crisis. And there will be a live performance weaving music, poetry and movement that the work responds to and asks how we might compost old structures, tend to grief and decompose inherited ways of being to make space for new composing imaginaries rooted in care, repair and collective liberation. And a reminder that that performance is on Wednesday, the 18th of February at 7 p.m. And there is also a free public program with RSVP required on Saturday, the 21st of February. And they are both at Next Wave at 270 Sydney Road, Brunswick.
Amazing. And after that, Inez spoke with Wani Toeshara and Hussein Abdirahman Mohammed about the upcoming Through Our Eyes photography exhibition, which invites audiences into a living archive of African Australian experiences and which is curated by Dr. Ibukun Olorantoba. And you can join them for their special opening night next Friday, the 13th of February at 6 p.m. at Black Dot Gallery, 33 Saxon Street in Brunswick, running till Sunday, the 8th of March. But we will have information in our show notes about the about how to register and RSVP. After that, we were joined by Samantha Floriani, digital justice advocate, writer and researcher, who spoke with us about digital rent technology.
and how they pose a distinct demonstrable threat to privacy and security, even though they may offer some conveniences. And finally, we were joined by Fiona York from Housing for the Aged Action Group to talk about the Victorian government's plans to demolish 7 older persons' public housing towers in the latest stage of its high-rise redevelopment program. Thanks so much for joining us on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR. We will catch you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.